Good to see all of you back this afternoon, despite the warning given by Jeff. Jeff said that, you know, his sermon was a little short this morning, so I'm going to reserve the right to use whatever time you didn't, along with my own this afternoon. Jeff mentioned there were some things in our culture that were kind of amiss, and what I'm going to talk about this afternoon is going to take the same approach. I'm afraid that in our culture today we have forgotten what the Bible has said about certain things, and rather than establish matters, we want to try things in the court of public opinion. And so I want to talk to you today about two or three witnesses. We recognize that this is a topic that is mentioned three or four times in the New Testament. In Matthew 18, 16, this was a part of Matthew 18, 15. You recognize that Brother Heath preached a sermon on this lesson, on this passage, and I don't want to repeat a lot of what he said, but you will notice some of the similarities in what I have to say. It's also found in 2 Corinthians 13 and verse 1. Found in 1 Timothy 5:19 and Hebrews 10:28. What I want you to take from this is not so much the passages that are quoted here, but the fact that the gospel writers under inspiration call to our attention this witness passage, this witness principle. And so it's not just an Old Testament principle, but it is referred to in the New Testament, is therefore something that we need to understand. We also understand that this principle was found in Deuteronomy 19:15, the passage that Brother Jordan just read, and we'll be looking at that some this afternoon. But we also recognize that the original readers of the New Testament were well grounded in Old Testament law, probably more than we are. For some reason, we as Christians tend to look away from the Old Testament. We'd rather read the New Testament. But let us understand that if we do not understand this particular principle, we might have a hard time understanding these four passages that are in the New Testament. So I want to go back and take a look at the fundamentals of this thing. Deuteronomy 19:15. It says that one witness shall not rise against a man. And this number one, you know, is going to take two or three witnesses. That's the title of the sermon. But one witness shall not rise. We understand that the witness is a person who saw something happen, a spectator. You know, a lot of times the Harveys and Brother Roger Lawson, we go out for lunch on Sunday, and they have talked about going to Cleveland and watching LeBron James play basketball. Now, I kind of doubt that when the game is over that they know just exactly how many points LeBron James scored, but I'm certain that they can tell you who won. And so they are eyewitnesses or witnesses of this game, and they can tell you who won that game. But, of course, there's a whole arena full of people that can do the same thing. But, again, there will be two of them. And secondly, we talk about being able to see. Part of that being a witness is hearing also, that we're there and we're able to see and we're able to hear people talk and we're able to understand them. So the witness is a spectator. But there are some people that are not witnesses. And this is one of the principles, again, we need to get a hold of. Because in John chapter 5 and verse 31, Jesus said, "If I bear witness of myself, my witness is not true." Well, wait a minute. Wasn't Jesus perfect? Wasn't what he said the truth? Did he lie in these cases? But that's not the point that's being made here. That we do not have people who are involved in a matter are witnesses of the matter. We call them perpetrators in our day and time, and we call them victims. But we understand that the perpetrator and the victims have, as we would say, an axe to grind. they're not going to tell you anything that is detrimental to them. And so we need to understand that these people have a biased testimony. And the Pharisees also recognized that in John chapter 8 and verse 13, when he said, they said the same thing, that if you bear witness of yourself, your witness is not true. In other words, what they did is they did not tend to believe what the people involved had to say necessarily. Did some of them tell the truth? Yeah. Did they tell all the truth? That's where the question comes in. So we need to understand that the witnesses are not those involved in the act. And the question is then, what happens? What if one rises? What if one witness comes up? Well, if he does, he has sin. I understand this particular passage that says one witness shall not rise is a command, not a suggestion. We talk about the Ten Commandments, and you look at the verbiage in the Ten Commandments as thou shalt not. Doesn't this say one witness shalt not? So it's a command and not a suggestion. If that individual rises, then that individual has sinned. But sometimes more importantly, we need to understand that if we hear that witness, if we take action when that witness rises, then we have sinned. The hearer is put in harm's way, and we'll talk about that just a little bit more as we go along. So if one person rises or one witness rises, then they have sinned. Now, the second thing we need to know about Deuteronomy 19:15 is that it covers any sin or any iniquity. Brother Jeff this morning had reference to the death penalty. And certainly there are passages that say about the same thing as Deuteronomy 19:15, and they specifically mention things worthy of death. And certainly as we look at our laws today and our laws back then, there were certain sins that were worthy of death. But death is just one of those sins. When it says any iniquity or any sin, murder would be included in that, but murder is not the only thing in there. God deals with sin, a small sin as we might consider, as in the same manner as a large sin. You know, we tend to classify sin as little sins and big sins. But when we're talking about here, when it says any iniquity or any sin, it's talking about even the smallest of sins, God's going to deal the same way. And if we're going to have a conviction or a discussion about these to try to determine guilt, then the guilt is established in the matter of two or three witnesses. And again, Deuteronomy chapter 17, verse 6, again, talks about the death penalty, but it says, he shall not be put to death at the testimony of one witness. And just to drive the point home, if you will, Numbers 35 and 30 says, one witness is not sufficient. So there's several different ways of saying the same thing, that the testimony of one witness is not to be acted upon. Well, you say, that person that's telling us, he's a pretty good guy. He's never told me a lie. What we're talking about here is not whether or not what is being said is true, but whether or not what is being said is sufficient to convict somebody of a sin. So we have then a crime and a punishment principle. And we see that a punishment is not carried out with less than three individuals. There is the perpetrator or the victim, or maybe both, and two witnesses. That doesn't mean that you can bring the perpetrator and one witness and fulfill what God has said here. It requires two witnesses. Now, we understand that in this particular day and time, we didn't have DNA, we didn't have blood type, we didn't have fingerprints. We don't have all the things that people consider evidence today, and the witnesses being talked about here were people. Fingerprint doesn't have a mouth. DNA doesn't have a mouth. And so we're looking there. Now, Jeff mentioned again the death penalty. I think the death penalty has been wrongfully carried out and been proven so in a lot of cases in our society and in our memory. But what they didn't do was require two or three witnesses in order to carry it out. And we need to get back to that particular principle that we've got two or three witnesses before certain penalties are carried out. And the death penalty in this case, but any penalty. You know, there has been occasions here when we've had to, what we call, discipline people. And if we were to discipline them on the mouth of one witness, we would be wrong. Even though their characteristics may be sinful, may be wrong, may not be what God wants them to be, but one witness shall not be permitted for this to happen. In most cases, when we have disciplined people, we include the fact that they are not faithful in their attendance. And it's not just the elders that witness this. You today can look around and see who's not here. And in that sense, you are witnesses, and there are a number of witnesses that could testify to that fact. So punishment is not carried out with more, less than three people. In 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 19, one of the passages we talked about earlier, it says, "Against an elder, accept not an accusation." And some people have wanted to take this and say, well, the laity, if you will, we can take this accusation, we can take this principle that's been charged, but it's not an elder. Well, don't really think that's true, because if we go back and look at the Old Testament, it says that a man, one or two, one witness shall not rise up against a man. It didn't say elder, it didn't say priest, it didn't say any of the religious individuals under the Old Testament. But it's talking about rising up against a man. That's me. That's you. One witness shall not rise up against a man. It doesn't make any difference whether you've been appointed an elder, been appointed a deacon, whether you're the preacher. The fact that there's an accusation against a person. So we need to reject that. Now, what does it mean to reject? What does it mean to accept? If we accept an accusation, then we tend to pursue that accusation. There is no scripture in the New Testament or the Old Testament that says that if I hear an accusation that I am to pursue that. Two or three witnesses are to be brought with the accusation. If those two or three witnesses are not there, we're to throw it out. In today's language, in court language, you throw it out of court. You know, every once in a while you hear about the Supreme Court not hearing certain cases. And that's what it should be here. If we have less than two witnesses, is we should throw it out. We shouldn't hear it. We shouldn't act upon it. So reject the accusation against anybody that comes with less than two witnesses. Then secondly, the witnesses must be examined. And in the reading, this, as Brother Jordan went through it, it says, if a false witness arises against any man to testify against him of wrongdoing, then both men shall, in the controversy, shall stand before the Lord, before the priests, and before the judges who serve in those days, and then the judges shall make careful inquiry. And we're talking about a false witness here, and we understand that there are people who are false witnesses. There are some people out there who would love to tear you down, would love to make you look small. And we run into this a lot of times in the religious world, where some of our religious denominations, or even some of our religious reporters on the TV, would love to demean us and put all of these false statements out. But if we are to examine the witnesses, we're to check for the credibility. So again, in Deuteronomy 19:16 through 18, it talks about these false witnesses. But there's one important point, I think, in this particular passage that not only does the world forget about, but we forget about. And that is the penalty for being a false witness. I think in court a lot of times they would call that perjury. and perjury is threatened, but we never see in our lawyer movies and court movies a case where it's being brought before the judge concerning perjury. They always threaten it. They got some murder case up here. They got some thief up there, and somebody tells them wrong and said, under the penalty of perjury, where you still make the same statement. But we never see it penalized. But when one witness arises and that one witness sins, and under the Old Testament law, that one witness who rose up without any other people to help him would be punished with the same punishment he sought to get in the court. If this man was accused of murder and a false witness arose to testify against him, and the witness was found to be false, that witness would be put to death because that's what he was trying to do to the accused. We need to understand that, because a lot of times we're out here and people make accusations, and when they turn out not to be true, we don't come back and penalize them. But understand this, is God's law, and though we may forget to punish the false witness, God will punish them. It's His law that has been broken. Now, I've already said one of the ways that we examine witnesses, and this is mentioned in Mark chapter 14 and verse 56, it said, many false witnesses arose, and they were rising against Jesus. He says, but their testimony did not agree. I don't think we really need to investigate the validity or the veracity of a single witness, because that should not be allowed to start with. But when there are two witnesses or three witnesses or six witnesses, we need to examine them and see that their testimony agrees. If there's no agreement in the testimony, one of them is false. Maybe two of them. We don't know. But they must be examined to see that their stories agree. Now, this doesn't mean that every word is exactly like every word of the other witness. But what's being examined here is whether or not on a particular point their testimony agrees. I saw you at 1 o'clock on the corner of 3rd and Main. Well, no, it took place at the corner of 3rd and 3rd Street and some other street. I can't think of them right now. But they have to be in the same... the testimony that they saw him do it must be in the same place. Well, it was 10 o'clock in the morning. No, it was 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Their testimonies doesn't agree on those particular points. It doesn't mean that they include everything that happened. So again, when we're talking about this, we're to make sure that there's plenty of witnesses. We're to examine those witnesses and things, see what happens. And I put this in red because that's the conclusion that we need to come to. Crime must be established. You know, far too often in today's world, things are out there, and as I said before, they're tried in the court of public opinion. But we as Christians need to have a higher standard than what is out there in our culture. We need to establish the crime before anything else happens. Now, there are some pitfalls and there are some misconceptions. And these things happen to us in all time. First of all, we have the tendency sometimes that when we hear about something, when something is told about us, when one witness comes to us, there is the conception that we go find the witnesses. A lot of times when some people tell you something, they want you to do their dirty work, so to speak, and do the investigation and go out and do this. Now, before you say something about somebody, in any situation, any setting, you need to have those two or more witnesses that will back up what you have to say. Wow, you calling me a liar? I've heard that several times. No. I'm calling you what God calls you. He calls you one witness. And He tells me that one witness is not to be heard, is not to be acted upon. What it says is that you may have the truth, and what He says may well be the truth, but you have not established it. And each of us as Christians need to work on established truth and not just the speaking or the message of one particular man. The other thing, again, as I just talked about, is we tend to believe that an accusation is established truth. We would pick people who are faithful Christians who are here every Sunday, and if they say something, we think it's got to be the truth. They never lie. And that's not what's being addressed here. What's being addressed is they have not established truth. But we tend to do that, and once we hear something, we tend to activate or go out and investigate to see if what was said was true. But if it wasn't, what do? You need to understand that the accuser with one witness is the same as a liar as far as the law is concerned. They may say the truth and may believe what they say. But we are not to believe that. We are to make sure that truth is established. The problem is, if you read Proverbs 18:8, it says the words of a talebearer are like tasty trifles. And last week I went through that, and I looked at that, and I looked at that. And every time I looked at it, it reminded me of Forrest Gump. Life is a box of chocolates. And when it comes to gossip, when it comes to unestablished truth, we seem to be anxious for them. We'll reach into that box of chocolates and take it. But he said those things go down into the innermost body. Those things can make you believe things that are not established. And so they are there, and it's one of the things that we have as a pitfall as each individual is, for whatever reason, we want to hear the bad news. You've heard people say it a long time before that what sells newspapers is bad news. And certainly if you pick up your newspaper, you watch the TV, there are a lot of pundits out there who are putting bad news up. They are putting unverified truth up there. And it is in the case that tears people down, it points fingers at people, and we eat it up. For whatever reason, we seem to love it. We look at the TVs and the newspapers, and their subscription rates, number of people that watch them. And then you look at, and I keep thinking RFTV. I don't know whether any of you watch that or not, but there's a lot of things in there about the farm market and animals. And you see things like the Jimmy Dean show back in 1965. And I guarantee you, they don't have near the ratings that some of our cable news networks have. And what our cable news networks feed us is nothing but bad news. So we need to be careful of the words of the talebearer. Secondly, one of the pitfalls we run into and why we should not listen to or why we should reject one witness, even cut him off at the pass. Somebody comes up and says, "Have you heard about?" Shut up. Now think about that. Why do you not want to hear? One of the first reasons you don't want to hear is because it's going to bias you. Proverbs 18:17 says, "The first person to plead his case seems right." And then they add the provision, "until his neighbor examines him." First one to plead his case. How many times have you, in your lifetime, I know it's happened to me, maybe it's not happened to some of you, have somebody come up here and or come to you and given you this story about somebody or some group? And boy, you're exactly right. We need to do this or we need to do that. But then when you find out the other side of the story, or as Paul Harvey used to say, when you find out the rest of the story, it's altogether different. You come to a different conclusion when you get the whole matter. So bear in mind that people are working on you when they give you this one witness testimony, and knowing that the first one to plead his case seems right. Now some people say, "Oh no, that's not right." Yes, it is right. God caused that to be written. God knows us. and He knows what we desire and what we do and how we react. Other things that we fall into is that the nature of the sin determines the actions required. I mentioned a little while ago about we look at these little sins and then there's these great big sins. And we classify them, but yet when we're heard, and I've heard this here at Knollwood many years ago, well, there's some sin out there, we got to do something. Yes, we do. But we got to do it right. We cannot waive these requirements in Deuteronomy chapter 19 based on the nature of the sin, or based on the fact sometimes that we don't have witnesses, we don't have evidence of anything. But oh, it's hurting our reputation. Yeah, it may be hurting our reputation. But you know what hurts our reputation more? Is when we don't deal fairly with the sins that are there. We got to do something, yes, but we got to do whatever is right. So let's take a look at a proper application. As I said earlier, Brother Heath preached a sermon a couple of weeks ago that covered Matthew 18 and verse 15. And he did a very good job. This is not, sermon is not intended to rebuke Heath or rebut anything or say that he did anything wrong, because he didn't. He had a very good sermon. But what it boils down to is that Matthew 15, 18 gives us a basic outline on how we are to apply the law. And while Matthew 15, 18 here dealt specifically with a brother sinning against a brother, it also illustrates and gives us some feeling as to how the law was applied. And it starts out with go and tell him his fault between you and him alone. That's the beginning point. And it talks about there, if he will hear you, you have saved your brother. You have gained your brother. And that's what we're looking for. Any time that we want to deal with sin or transgression, the objective should be to save that brother, to bring them back into a covenant relationship with God. But there's also in Acts chapter 18 and verse 24 through 27 an approved example. Now, if you go over and you read that, this was where there was a certain Jew named Apollos. And Apollos was instructed in the way of the Lord, and he was very fervent. And he spoke and taught accurately the things of the Lord, though he knew only the baptism of John. Now, if I stood up here today and I preached the baptism of John, you would recognize that there was something wrong and something that needed to be taken care of. And so you would understand that I needed something. But notice what they did. It says, when Aquila and Priscilla heard him, they took him aside. Now, does not that sound like Matthew 18? That they took him aside privately, even though he had publicly preached error? So let me say to you that even in those situations, that the beginning point is a private meeting, a private instruction, a private attempt to restore and to work the situation out. They took him aside. Now, if we understand what Brother Heath said, and we understand this approved example here, we understand that the offender must be given the opportunity to make corrections with as little embarrassment as possible. I can see where Aquila and Priscilla might have come in and looked up at Apollo and said, sit down, you false teacher. Here's what needs to be taught. What do you think Apollos would have felt if that took place? Would he have been embarrassed? The same embarrassment comes when the teller or the individual in Matthew 18 goes out and tells anybody else of the fault of one brother. when it works back around to him, he's going to be embarrassed. Well, maybe he won't be embarrassed, but at least you have gone to see him. He may be belligerent, and he may not want to resolve the matter. But the offender must be given the opportunity to make corrections with as little embarrassment as possible. This is good for the individual. It's good for the congregation. The less we know about sin and the sins our brothers commit, the better off we are, especially when they've taken care of them. If you have sinned and you've taken care of that sin, it needs to be put away, never to be brought up again to turn somebody against you. So again, well, let's look at Matthew 18:15. Brother Heath made this comment, and I don't want any of you telling me that the font's too small. I did this on purpose because what you see up there is oftentimes how we practice what God has told us. We read that as go and tell. Well, if I understand that right, if your first telling is to anybody other than the offending brother, you have sinned. Too many times we pay more attention to the accusation than the teller. But the teller is also sinned. He has gone against what the Bible has to say. Is go and tell him, not somebody else. And there can be no doubt about this sin. When you come and tell me about something about some other brother and you have not spoken to him first, you've sinned. But it goes a little bit farther than that. And this is a kind of aside here. We must deal with the one who has sinned, the one who has told, because now we have two sins. We're showing partiality if we deal with one and not the other. So we have two examples. But now there are some options that we have. If somebody offends us, we can take the wrong. 1 Corinthians 6, chapter 4, verse 7, they were talking there about Christians taking one another to court. And Paul says, why would you do this? Why would you not rather take the wrong? Why would you rather expose the church to the condemnation of the world by always being in court, always taking one another to court, always trying to settle things there? Is there not somebody among you that can make decisions? Is there not somebody there? And for example, you might take the wrong. Now, I'm going to say here that if it's a matter of sin against God, there's nothing for us to take. But we're talking about matters between individuals. Secondly, Proverbs chapter 17 and verse 9 talks about covering up things. And he's talking about covering up what somebody has done. Now, if we cover it up, what do we do? Well, I'll tell you here in just a minute. Somebody put glue on this paper here. It didn't come apart. It says, he covers a transgression. He seeks love. But he who repeats separates friends. And I'm sure that many of you have looked around here and have seen friends separated because of transgressions, and not only because of transgressions, because somebody has made accusation. So we can cover a transgression and seek love, but we repeat it and we sow discord. In James chapter 5 and verse 20, he says, let him that know that he who turns a sinner from the error of his way will save a soul from death and cover a multitude of sins. You know, we've always had discussions in our Bible class about what covers a multitude of sins. I'm not persuaded that it erases sin or it takes away the penalty for sin, but I'm persuaded that covering a multitude of sins, that means if I don't tell somebody something, they don't fall into the trap of telling somebody else. They don't fall into the trap of sinning. And all of this discord and all of this division will not occur if I can turn that sinner from the error of his way without exposing him to the rest of us. And the same thing that is talked about in 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 8, he says, "And above all things, have fervent love for one another, for love will cover a multitude of sins." This love that we have, the love that we want to have with people to not expose them to embarrassment, to not embarrass them with a lot of accusation that it can't be backed up. We can prevent a lot of sins, not only with the individual that's there, but with those who might hear what is being said. Well, in Matthew 18, 16, we've got another thing, and Heath didn't cover this, but I thought about it. He gave me the idea that we rewrite Matthew 18, 16. Instead of take with you, we say, go and tell one or two more. And I've seen this happen. Maybe you have seen it too, that when telling something about somebody else doesn't produce the results you'd like to get, well, maybe I need to tell one or two more. And by the same token, if this second telling is not between the offender and the witnesses, you have sinned if you're the teller. Again, what does the text tell us? It says, take with you one or two more, and when you get to where you're going to meet, here you've got the participants, and there are two witnesses there, and their primary purpose is to establish every word. Now, for a long time in my youth, when people would talk about these things, it would almost appear that these one or two witnesses now would establish the truth about the offense. But the offense is not validated here by the witnesses. What is witnessed here is the conversation. If Mike and I have a problem and we're trying to work it out, and there are two witnesses here, the witnesses will verify, test to the words that were spoken in that meeting. So their purpose there is to establish what it is. In that way, when we take a look at the order, this occurs in the Scripture before telling it to the church. So now we can't work things out, and we need to bring it to the church, and the witnesses are there. What that says is that no new subject will be brought up where it is in the church, because the witnesses will say, well, you guys didn't talk about that, or you didn't talk about this. And then it proceeds on from there, and other ways of trying to resolve this. But we need to understand that these things are still talking about things that need to be done in the order that they need to be done and the scriptural way that needs to be done. There are, however, some snares. Satan's snares. You know who's behind all of this? Satan. He will do his best to drive a wedge between me and you. He will do his best to drive a wedge in the congregation. He will do his best to get us to pick sides and argue with one another. He will do our best that when we begin to pick sides, to split off one side or the other. All of these belong to Satan and all these things that happen. But some of the snares, I want to talk about Proverbs 18:8, with information that is unestablished, you have the potential of being a talebearer. Yeah, sometimes we get things so juicy that we just can't keep them in. We got to tell somebody. We got to do this. We got to do that. No, brethren, we got to do it right. If you're the type of person who finds out something and just got to tell somebody, stay away from those people that want to tell you. Don't hear those words. But it gives there's a potential of being a talebearer when somebody tells you something. Secondly, in Proverbs 18:13 and in verse 17, it talks about a couple of things. You know, the individual who pleads his case first seems to be right. And then the second thing is that if we answer a matter before we hear it, and he's talking about hearing all of it, hearing all the established truth, it's a shame to us and foolish. And what this means is that we jump to a conclusion. You may have heard me say this before, but I remember Brother Rodney Smith, when he was here, used to talk about the most exercise any of us get is jumping to conclusions. And we will do that. We'll come to the conclusion without hearing the whole matter. Secondly, we want to repeat that and separate friends. This is sinful. So when we have this information, all of these temptations are there in front of us. Those that hear are placed in harm's way. Used to remember years ago when they were talking about marriage, divorce, and remarriage that, you know, if you divorce your spouse, you put them in a position to commit adultery. Well, in this case, you put these individuals in a position to gossip. You put them in a position to spread something that not even they are a witness to. You know, that's one step up the line as we go in sin. So we don't need to be placing one another in harm's way. There are some difficulties that we will run into as we progress in this matter. Deuteronomy 17:18 says there are some things that are too hard to judge. There are some things that happen in this life that have no witnesses. I'm reminded of the passage in the New Testament where, remember, I think it was the Pharisees came to Jesus with a woman taken in adultery. And it says they were taken in the very act. And the reason it says that is because now there are two or three witnesses to the act. Most of the sexual sin that we see today, I don't think there's too many witnesses to the actual act. There may be some evidence that they were here and they were there and they were in this room, but nobody has seen the actual act. And it becomes difficult for us to judge. So there are matters that don't have a lot of established truth with which we are to judge. And there are things that degrees of guilt for bloodshed. You know, we have in our society, or we used to, I'm probably 30 or 40 years off of the laws, but you went from manslaughter through to first degree murder. I don't know what the categories are now, but there were several categories. And we need to decide that because in our laws, the categories were there because of the punishment that would be administered. And in the Old Testament law, there were cities of refuge where the people could go. But the cities of refuge, when they were there, were to bring in the witnesses and try them. And if they were found guilty, they were kicked out of that city of refuge. But in some cases, there was not enough evidence to convict, and the person could escape the punishment, escape the avenger of blood in these cities of refuge. There are one judgment or another, and that's what I'm talking about here, to categorize what the sin actually is and determine what judgment should be applied, and of course the punishment or the other. And there are matters of controversy within your own gates. You would think those ought to be able to be settled. But then, again, there are some matters that not. And then if all these difficulties are there, go to the place of the Lord which God chooses. And under the Old Testament, they could go to the place and God would reveal the judgment to the priests and things of this sort. We don't have that. What we have today is the New Testament, the Old Testament, and the Scriptures. And in order to determine what is there, we need to get it out of our own mind and go to the Bible to find out what God has said. It may be that for lack of evidence, for lack of witnesses, for lack of established truth, that we have to turn it over to God and let Him handle it in the after while, because we can't do it. It's just too difficult. But there are also some requirements that when we go about doing this, and one of the requirements is you're not to show partiality. The Bible talks about partiality. The New Testament talks about partiality. And there are places where partiality is shown. the judgments will go against the poor, remain the rich. We're looking about how much money we collect, and this individual gives a great deal of money, and so we will decide in his favor. But we're not to show partiality. We're to hear the small and the great, and this is what we're talking about. The poor and the rich, the famous and the unfamous, the absolutely faithful and the relatively faithful. We're to hear those and we're to put established truth in each case. So we're not going to kick out something because somebody is a smaller individual rather than a great individual. So we're to hear all things and establish truth in the same manner for all things. In our nation today, we've always had the accusation that people like O.J. Simpson got off because he hired the greatest lawyer or he paid the most money. And this accusation is always in front of us in the news that we don't hear the small and the great, and if you got enough money, you can buy your way out. We don't want that to happen in the church. Second, that we're not to be afraid of man's presence. You know, there are a few of you guys out there that are intimidating. You settle it my way, or, you know, we're out behind the barn explaining things. Or they may be powerful financially. You don't judge my way. I've got your job. I've got your fame and fortune. I'm going to ruin you because of my position. But we are not to fear that, because that's being impartial. That's something that God has told us not to do. And he says, we need to understand that the judgment is God's. We are to pursue all these things according to the scripture that God has given us, according to the plan that God has given us. And secondly, bring to me the hard cases. We're to look up in the scripture what to do. We're not to rely on our thoughts. We are an emotional people. And sometimes, rather than adhere to what God has to say, we want to put our emotion into things. In short, we need to consider only the established truth. Only established matters. If matters are not established with two or three witnesses, throw them out. Forget them. Put them in God's hands. God will eventually judge every sin and every fault. Well, for two or three witnesses, we need to remember it is the right of the accused to be convicted at the mouth of two or three witnesses. It is the right of the offender to resolve a matter with a minimum of embarrassment. We need to recognize the snares that are thrown in front of us when this gossip and this accusation is put before us without being established. That we too can sin by spreading it, by acting upon it, and several other things. And friends, this is my opinion right now. I think that's where the church over the years has exhibited a failure, because somebody will falsely accuse somebody and they'll find out the accusation is false. And the accuser is never disciplined. The accuser is never taught. The accuser is not given the same treatment and being able to convict them of wrongdoing. We need to recognize that there's difficulties, and we need to follow the requirements. Hear the word of the Lord. This passage struck me in this study. It's Proverbs 18:21. Death and life are in the power of the tongue, and those who love it will eat its fruit. And this is just another way of saying, you shall reap what you sow. When you talk against somebody without establishing the truth, somebody will talk against you in the same way. When you talk about somebody without having established truth, God sees it, and God will repay sooner or later. Heath mentioned in his sermon that beware, your sins will find you out. And this is sometimes true, and every once in a while, people die without ever having been found out, but God will find them out. It'll be too late for them to understand it. This certainly has not been a sermon that would tend to talk about conversion. This is not something that has been talked about to help you reach heaven, the step to salvation, but we all understand it. I'm reminded when I do some of these things of what my mother used to say, that there was a preacher back at Dewey Avenue where she used to go, that when he got to the end of his lesson, he'd say, "Well, you all know what to do. It's time to do it. Let's sing." Well, I'm not quite there yet, but the point of it is we know what it takes to become a Christian. We know what it takes to be restored as a Christian. And in the light of this sermon, we would all love to be witness to your induction into the kingdom of God. We would all love to be witness to see you restored. And if you have any need, we ask you that you would come as Brother Terry leads us in song.